and confirmations coming in from all of you that everything looks and sounds okay, let me provide a brief introduction to our presenters. We'll be joined by Amanda Van Epps, who's here at EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, where she's a Superfund Tribal Coordinator, in addition to working on post-construction policy. Next, Rachel Lentz from the EPA Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization will join us, where she's a grants team leader. We'll also be joined by Christine Poor in the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, where Christine chairs the National Remedy Board. And then we'll be joined by Tina Conley in EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, where she serves as the Superfund Community Involvement University Program Manager. Lastly, Bob Schwack from US EPA Region 1 in their Remedial Policy Contracts and Site Assessment section will join us. He is also EPA Region 1's Technical Assistance Grant Coordinator. So I hope you will join me in welcoming our speakers, and then I'll go ahead and call up their presentation content and turn it over to Amanda Van Epps to get things started. So Amanda, whenever you're ready to begin, please do.
Okay, thank you so much, Jean. I think first I just want to, you know, thank everyone for joining us today. Obviously, there's a lot going on in the world and, you know, in each and every one of our communities, and I know there's a lot of, competing demands on everyone's time right now, so we do appreciate you, you know, joining the webinar today. We know that there may be some of your colleagues who are unable to join today either because their tribal government is just closed right now or because where they're currently working from, they don't have the, you know, the internet connection that's able to stream a webinar. So as Jean said, this will be available recorded and online afterwards, so if you find the information useful and you have colleagues that weren't able to join us today, you know, please pass it along to them. I think that all of us on the EPA side are, you know, just trying to keep doing our jobs to the best of our ability under challenging circumstances and unique circumstances. So we're going to, you know, keep trying to be a resource to all of you where we can be. I will go ahead and get started and say that we are going to cover brownfields and Superfund funding vehicles for tribes today. I do just want to say that this is supposed to be sort of a general overview. We're not talking about a specific competitive process that's that's underway right now or a specific pot of money. This is really just supposed to be sort of a level-setting presentation so that when you know, our EPA colleagues talk with our tribal partners, everyone's on the same page and is using the same language to start the conversation. So I think if I advance, that did. Jean, can we go to the first poll as I do that, please? I think hopefully in a minute you will see a poll at the bottom of your screen. We're just trying to get a sense of who's out there and, you know, the audience that we're talking to so that we can, you know, tailor what we're saying to who we're speaking to. We are going to cover three sort of big items today. The first is Rachel's going to talk about funding opportunities and vehicles that they administer through the Brownfields program here at EPA. Christine will talk about our Superfund Subpart O funding opportunities, which are our cooperative agreements that we administer through Superfund. And then Tina and Bob are going to talk about a couple of opportunities for technical assistance, which are a little different from these other categories, but might be appropriate in situation, you know, in sort of site-specific situations or community-specific situations. So they'll cover that as well. And so it looks like we have a good variety of representation on the audience, our tribal partners, a few of our state partners, a lot of EPA people out there, so hello, EPA colleagues, as well as some other representation. So it's good for us to just have a sense of who we're talking to, so thank you. And Christine and Rachel will have a couple more polls later on to get a sense of your experience with both Brownfields and Superfund. I think the other thing that I want to do just up front in terms of, you know, setting the table is just go over a couple of the terms that you might hear throughout the presentation. or in some of your conversations with EPA folks. So the first is to define CERCLA. CERCLA is the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. It was a law passed by the U.S. Congress in 1980, has been subsequently amended a number of times. But this was sort of a means that, or a law that provided broad federal authority to respond directly to releases of hazardous substances that may endanger public health or the environment. But in reality, CERCLA and some of the later amendments really provided a number of different ways for EPA to address contaminated land. And so, you know, the Brownfield and Land Revitalization Program was one program that arose out of CERCLA and its later amendments. And again, Rachel will be talking in that area. And then also the Superfund Remedial Program that that we will also cover also comes out of the CERCLA law. Another term that you might hear at a number of points in this presentation is the National Priorities List, or the NPL. And that's a list that is published in the Federal Register, and it has, it's the list of sites that the EPA has identified as the most contaminated sites across the country that Superfund addresses and that we can spend Superfund money on. So if you hear the NPL or the National Priorities List, those are the contaminated sites that we work on under Superfund. Another term that you might hear is cooperative agreements, and that's sort of a mouthful that may not automatically know what that's referring to. So that's one of the ways that EPA is able to provide CERCLA funding to states or their political subdivisions or tribes, and it is a primary source of CERCLA funding to tribes. It is, as it says here, a legal instrument that EPA uses to transfer money, property, services, or anything of value to a recipient to accomplish a public purpose in which substantial EPA involvement is anticipated during the performance of the project. It's a pretty versatile way for EPA to provide funding. It will usually, you know, a cooperative agreement will identify who EPA is providing funding to, how much funding they are providing. It will have some terms and conditions that both parties are agreeing to for, you know, administration of that grant. And it will usually also have a statement of work, or, you know, summarize the activities that are going to be, that money is going to be used to implement. So I think with that, I will hand it off to Rachel, who will talk about our funding opportunities in the Brownfields program.
Thank you, Amanda. Everyone, my name is Rachel Lentz, and I work at EPA's Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization. And I think there'll be two poll questions just to help me get a sense of how familiar you are with Brownfields. First, we are going to talk about, so there's two big types of funding sources for federal funds for brownfield that the CERCLA statute that Amanda just briefly mentioned gives EPA authority to. The first one I'm going to talk about is our non-competitive grant program, our state and tribal response program. And when CERCLA was amended in 2002, it provided statutory authority for this grant program for states and tribes to establish and enhance a response program. What does that mean? That is it's commonly referred to like the source of funding from the federal government for states and tribes to like set up their brownfields program. Now the funding can be used for a little bit capacity building broader than brownfields. But that's like the kind of big pot of money to set up those programs. And any federally recognized Indian tribe and states and territories are eligible for that funding. And it is non-competitive. It is a funding program where you have to request funds every year, and we do an annual allocation. And this past year, FY20, we received about 170 requests from across the country, and it was about 50 tribes, 5 territories, and about 168 or 112 tribes requesting funding. And those numbers are pretty typical every year. And just broadly, like, this funding, like, sets up your program so you can use it to hire staff and develop regulations and ordinances and plans and develop outreach and do community involvement and training and some specific assessments and cleanups on brownfield land. So it's really key money to help tribes and states sort of develop their brownfields programs. this slide just kind of provides an overview of what is required of the funding for the statute. And there's no cost share requirement. Some other grant programs at EPA do require a cost share, but this program does not. So the statute provides, lays out four what we call key elements, things that each response program, each tribal or state brownfields program needs to have for receiving funding from us to be establishing or enhancing from where they are kind of in the life cycle of their program. So the first is timely survey and inventory brownfield sites. We want to know how many brownfields you kind of have in your jurisdictions and your communities that sort of need sort of oversight and resources to address and kind of revitalize and bring back in your community. The second one is that you have oversight and enforcement authorities that you can ensure that a response action is protective of human health and the environment, as in if, like, that site needs to be cleaned up and reused, that you have authority to do that and enforce your own rules and jurisdictions to make sure that's cleaned up for the end use that the community wants on for the specific site. The third key element is to provide a meaningful opportunities for public participation, including access to what sites you are proposing to do and spend your resources on, and sites you have just cleaned up, so people just know where the sites have been addressed with this funding in your community and what's been happening and where they have opportunities to provide comment on potential cleanup plans or reuse plans and play an active role in the revitalization of their communities. And lastly is the fourth key element is that there's a mechanism to approve cleanup plans and ensure that cleanups are complete with any site that found to have contamination is kind of enrolled in a state or tribal response program, and then you can certify that the cleanup has been complete and it's cleaned up to your state or tribal standards. And then the last statutory requirement is what's called the public record. And so each entity that continually sees money in our program has to demonstrate at least once a year they've identified any site that they're proposing to do action on or have just completed action on. And if it can't be cleaned up to unrestricted use, that there's an institutional control in place, that there's kind of a control in place to ensure, like, we're not putting homes that can only be resited for industrial because it wasn't cleaned up, you know, have a family bed put back on it. And the non-competitive grant program, another eligible activity is allowable is to do site assessments. Those have to meet the definition of a brownfield. So that's any site that has or you might think has contamination on it. So you can do an assessment to see if there is contamination on it. And then if there is, you can use some funds to clean up the site to the appropriate end use to meet your needs. One thing to know, sites that are on the national priority list or are known as Superfund sites that others will be talking about later in this presentation are not eligible to be brownfield sites. That is a statutory limitation, so it's sort of like you're in one lane or the other. Okay, and then the other big bucket of funding that the brownfields program has that tribes are eligible for are our competitive grants. And as you can see listed on the slide, we have four main competitive grants that tribes are successful at competing and receiving. So the first one are our assessment grants. So tribes can, along with states, nonprofits, units of local governments are all eligible for our competitive grants, and our assessment grants are really flexible, key grants to help communities just sort of take an inventory and characterize brownfield sites, do some planning to propose for reuse, or do cleanup and planning if contamination is identified, funding to provide for community involvement, and kind of give the community information, give the tribe information about what to do next after it's determined what the level of contamination is at a site. And these, our assessment grants are by far our most popular grant type. In our annual competition, the most entities are requesting assessment grant funds. Next are our cleanup grants. So EPA provides up to $500,000 for an eligible entity, including tribes, to assess up one or more eligible sites for cleanup funding. And many tribes are really successful at getting these competitive grants, and this is just really helpful to find cleanup dollars to clean up these properties. We also have our revolving loan fund grants, and though that grant program is for typically larger entities like states or redevelopment areas to provide loans or sub-grants to entities to clean up sites, we have not yet had a tribe be successful for those, but they are eligible for them. And then we have a new grant program that we just received authorization for in 2018 for our multi-purpose grants, and those grants are to do assessment and cleanup activities in the same cooperative agreement, and so that's pretty exciting. And a tribe received one of those last year, so we're really excited to see how they are successful and kind of able to use that new grant program to benefit their community. And lastly, I wanted to talk about our Environmental Workforce Development Job Training Grant Program. This is like a small grant program. We only do about 12 to 13 grants per year, but it is really critical because it provides funding to recruit, train, place unemployed and underemployed residents of communities affected by the contamination, like the brownfields and the Superfund sites within their communities. And we have had successful tribal colleges and organizations receive these grants from before, or organizations that are focusing primarily on supporting tribal communities to gain the skills to kind of enter the environmental field. And all those grant programs are run almost, our assessment, our cleanup, and our environmental workforce development job training grants are run every year. And every late summer, early fall, we try and issue those guidelines out each year. And we have webinars to promote, you know, each year's round of competitive funding. And so for FY20, we're currently in the review process, and we'll announce in the spring. And if you're interested in those grant funds, kind of look out for competitive funding opportunities in this upcoming August and September. And lastly, I just wanted to share like other resources we have to support tribes, to just brownfields. We currently have a cooperative agreement that with Kansas State University that is entirely focused on helping provide technical assistance to tribes related to brownfield sites in their communities, and you don't have to have an existing grant with EPA to utilize their support. And they have a broad range of support from helping anyone understand like what is a brownfield to like specific questions about reviewing any technical documents related to a specific site, or can help with visioning or reuse planning or leveraging and finding dollars to kind of complete the redevelopment funding. Second, EPA has some funding available to through our targeted brownfields assessment program, where EPA's contractors will perform an assessment on behalf of a community, and many tribes have been very successful in requesting those targeted brownfield assessment funds. And you can contact your regional brownfields coordinator or tribal coordinator to kind of learn about more about if you have a site that might be a perfect fit for those funds. It can probably find funds to communities to get assessments a little bit faster than our competitive grant funds opportunities, which can take about a year from when the application is submitted to when the funding is awarded to the community. And then lastly, we have a new grant program that's attached to the State and Tribal Response Program grants, and it is up to $200,000 to provide technical assistance for a discrete project. That is a very brand new program. We had about 8 tribes utilizing it last year, so FY19 was the first year of doing that, and I was hoping to get some great success stories at the end of the summer about those projects, but with just the current situation in the world, many of those might just be on pause a little bit, so hopefully by next year we'll know more about the success of that program and how to utilize it more in the future. And lastly, here is just in the presentation a list of the Brownfield Tribal Regional contacts. If you have any questions, you can reach out to them about specific opportunities related to Brownfield. I am Jean. Do we have time for a few questions?
Yes, we do. And I'm going to take a few questions to sort of come in if sites can move from one program to the next. So is it possible that a Superfund site could turn into a Brownfield site, or vice versa? Can Brownfields become Superfund sites?
I don't know about a Brownfield becoming a Superfund site. I guess that's possible, but yes, if a Superfund site becomes delisted, so it kind of makes it all the way through EPA's process and becomes delisted, then it's no longer a Superfund site and can be eligible for Brownfield funding in our program. But it's just sort of, if it's active on the NPL list, then it's not a Brownfield. And then I think if it's,
okay. All right. We also had a question. They just were curious, which tribe was awarded the new multi-purpose grant?
Let me get another question while I go online and just want to make sure I have it. All who is selected for our grants every year is available on our website, and you can always search. I'll do that. You have another question while I'm trying to look
it up. We do. So this one is asking, is it a requirement that a tribe have a full Brownfields, quote, program before it applies for competitive funding?
No. I think the main thing for competitive funding is if you have sites you sort of need to assess or clean up or need to then that's what that funding is for. So no, you don't need to have a complete program to be able to access those competitive grant funds.
Okay. All right. So I'll wait just a moment here. I'll remind everyone that, again, if you have a question or comment, you can answer it into the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. I do know that some of you may be only on the phone lines. We will pause later for questions by phone. Just in the interest of time, we'll take the electronic ones first, and then later on today we'll take a break, and those of you on the phone lines can unmute. So I'm not sure if, Rachel, you wanted to try to dig up that answer now, or if perhaps we'll come back to it later on in the webinar.
Yeah, I just found it. So it's the White Mountain Apache Housing Authority in the Fort Apache Reservation in Arizona that received a 2019 Brownfield multi-purpose grant.
Okay. All right. So I think with that, what we'll do is go ahead and move on to the next section. And I, if I'm not mistaken, Christine Poor, you'll be our next speaker. Christine, are you with us on the phone?
I am. Thank you, Jean. Hi, everybody. My name is Christine Poor. I'm with EPA's Superfund program. Jean will be posting a poll question at the bottom of your screen to give me an idea about your familiarity with the Superfund program. So I'd greatly appreciate it if you could post on that. Okay, it looks like a lot of people with experience. So let's jump right into Subpart O, shall we? So Subpart O codifies Section 104D1 of CERCLA. And so what Subpart O does is it identifies tribal eligibility requirements for all six of the cooperative agreements that we have available. It outlines those types of cooperative agreements, and it also outlines the requirements in administering the cooperative agreements. So it details financial administration, personal property, real property, copyright, reporting, records, all of those requirements. We're going to focus mostly on just the different types of funding that are available rather than all of the specific like reporting requirements. And one limitation to take note of, though, is that Superfund money for remedial action cannot be used by recipients for federal facility cleanup activities. So in those cases, the funding should be sought from the federal entity that is undertaking the cleanup. So tribal eligibility. There are just a couple things that you need to do to be eligible to receive cooperative agreements through Superfund Subpart O. First is you have to be a federally recognized tribe. And then you also have to meet the criteria that is set forth in 300-515B of the NCP. And so that section discusses tribes being afforded substantially the same treatment as states, and we'll discuss that a little bit more in just a moment. It's important to note that the Subpart O definition of states does not actually include Indian tribes, and that's because tribes don't have to meet all of, they don't have to comply with all of the statutory requirements that the states have to meet. So because of that, each of the cooperative agreements have a section that pertains specifically to Indian tribes. And then also there's intertribal consortium that are eligible. So they're only eligible if they can demonstrate that all of their members of the consortium meet the eligibility requirements for the cooperative agreement and that all of the members authorize the consortium to apply for and receive the assistance. So 300-515B. So there's three requirements under this section. The first is, again, that you're federally recognized tribe. The second is that you have a tribal governing body that is currently performing governmental functions to promote health, safety, and welfare of the affected population or to protect the environment within a defined geographic area. And third, you have jurisdiction over a site at which a fund finance response, including pre-remedial actions, is contemplated. The one exception for this is the core program the poor program profit agreement. And those you do not have to demonstrate jurisdiction for because they're not site specific. So these are the six types of cooperative agreements that are available. There's pre-remedial, remedial, enforcement, removal, and then the big two are core program, and the biggest of those of all six is the support agency cooperative agreement. So these are administered by the region. So if you have a site or if you want to get a core program agreement, you would have to reach out to people in the region. So work with your RPM or an EPA contact there, and then we'll also have tribal coordinator contacts for each region at the end of the presentation. So as a quick summary from last year. Last year we approved just over $12 million were awarded for approximately 60 cooperative agreements. And if you take a quick look at the breakout below, you can see that while a large percentage of the funding went to a remedial action at a particular site, the vast majority of the types of cooperative agreements that were given out were the support agency agreements. So there was $3.4 million in cooperative agreements that were given to 16 different tribes, excluding the remedial action. And then for the support agency cooperative agreements, they totaled $2.8 million and that went to 14 different tribes last year. So for all of the cooperative agreements, there are a few common elements. The first is that you have to complete an application for federal assistance for non-construction programs. That's an SF-424. And it has to include budget sheets, a project narrative statement, and other applicable forms and information. So for the project narrative statement, the statement of work would include, say, a detailed description by task of activities to be conducted, the projected costs of each task, the number of products to be completed, and a quarterly submittal schedule. For health and safety, you don't have to provide the actual health and safety plan to get the cooperative agreement, but it must be made available if EPA requests it. And then for the quality assurance plan, that you would have to have an EPA non-site specific QAP in place before you can begin any field work. So the first type of the cooperative agreement is the pre-remedial response agreement. And so for these, the applicant would provide a list of sites that they would propose to undertake pre-remedial tasks at. And if you wanted to revise that list, you can, but you can't incur costs at a new site until the EPA project officer has approved it. And the eligible activities for pre-remedial response are the preliminary assessment, site inspection, and the hazard ranking system. So the next type is the remedial response cooperative agreement. And so this is, you know, the boots on the ground, taking the samples, digging the dirt, doing the work. And so this covers remedial investigations, feasibility studies, remedial design, remedial actions, overseeing PRP cleanups. And it's important to note that for CERCLA-funded remedial actions, Indian tribes are not required to do a cost share as states are. So the next is an enforcement cooperative agreement. And this one has a little bit more specificity when it comes to the eligibility. So the state or the tribe has to demonstrate that they have the authority, jurisdiction, and the necessary administrative capabilities to take on that enforcement role. And in terms of the letter that has to be submitted, the tribal official should be about comparable to the state attorney general. And then the activities that are covered are identifying PRPs, conducting settlement negotiations, and taking enforcement actions against PRPs. So next is the removal response cooperative agreement. And the CERCLA breaks removals into two different types. There are time-critical removals that have a planning period of less than 6 months, and then there's non-time-critical removals, and those have a planning period of more than 6 months. So the removal response cooperative agreement is specific to the non-time critical removal actions, those with a longer planning period of over 6 months. And that's because for removals that have a planning period of under 6 months, those are generally conducted by the EPA due to their time critical nature. But it is important to note that neither tribes nor states are required to share cost of a CERCLA-funded removal action. So now we're getting into the last two, which are the two that are the most used. So the first is the core program cooperative agreement. And so these are not for site-specific activities. They're for general management and administration responsibilities. So they can include a lot of financial administration, property, procurement, reporting, and other administrative requirements. And their intention is that they're intended to develop and maintain a state or tribe's ability to participate in the CERCLA response program. So to be eligible, it has to, again, meet the intention of developing and maintaining your ability to participate in the program. And then the core funding would go just to that one tribal entity or agency that is designated as the point of contact for CERCLA. And some of the eligible activities are listed here. So for, say, emergency response actions, those are including but not limited to the development of generic health and safety plans. Some of the provisions can be development of a fund or other financing mechanism to pay for studies. Legal authorities can be those associated with proper administration of the program and efforts to compel PRPs to conduct or pay for studies and remediation. And that's including but not limited to the development of statutory authorities, access to legal assistance in identifying ARRs, and developing and maintaining administrative, financial, and record-keeping systems. And then hiring and training staff is to hire and train them to manage publicly funded cleanups and oversee PRP cleanups. And so the last is the one that's the most used. It's by far the largest category of the cooperative agreements out there. And so this is the support agency cooperative agreement. So in this case, you're not boots on the ground doing the work, but you're working, you know, you're meeting with us, we're having discussions, reviewing documents, and working together to provide support to the lead agency, which is often EPA, to move the site forward. So one of the things you want to be sure about for the support agency cooperative agreement is that its purpose is to ensure your meaningful and substantial involvement in response activities, as specified in Sections 104, which refers to response authorities, and Section 121F1, which refers to state involvement of CERCLA and the NCP. So CERCLA 121F1 and the NCP subpart F both have almost identical lists of allowable activities. And then there's also participation in 5-year reviews, which is reviewing it rather than the writing of it. And so the slide summarizes all of the different activities from both 121F1 and subpart F. And so that's reviewing and commenting on the PASI, the RIFS, remedy selection, AOR waivers, you know, site deletion, engineering design, remedial action, and then also, you know, working with the EPA or the other, whoever the lead agency is on long-term planning, European negotiations, and the 5-year review process. And again, to be clear, these activities are for reviewing EPA documents, not conducting and drafting the documents and doing that work. And so, as I said, we have a list of contacts. These are the list of all the Superfund tribal coordinators in each of the regions who will be very happy to help put you in touch with the right person and help you through the cooperative agreement process. And so, Jean, do we have time for questions?
I think we do. I'm going to start with this first question, again, that came in electronically. Can tribes apply for a core program CA to develop an emergency response program?
You know, that I would have to look into because I don't know how much emergency response would fall under CERCLA, because we usually just do the time critical removal of actions. So I'd have to look into that.
Okay. And, Rachel, if you're on the line, I think this question might be for you, but let me read it out loud, and Christine, if you also think this belongs to Rachel, let me know. This participant wanted to know, is there a limit to the number of years an assessment grant can be applied for after it's been awarded, but not sufficient to fully assess? So I think, in other words, they apply for a grant to do a site assessment, but that grant only pays for part of what's needed. Can they keep reapplying for a certain period of time to get more grants in the subsequent years?
This is Rachel. Yes, but that's something to kind of want to work out with your project officer. So our assessment grants generally have 3-year cooperative agreement term, like the grant period of performance is 3 years. Some have been extended because entities can't spend all their money in 3 years because of various circumstances. If you have an assessment grant and you're assessing it and you need to do some additional assessment, yes, you can come in and compete again for additional site assessment work. There are some examples where that has happened, but you'd have to go again in the competitive process. And you need a newish threshold requirement we have for assessment grants is that any existing assessment grantee cannot come in and request additional funds until they've expended 70% of their current grant. Part of it was to address a perception problem that the same entities were continually getting our funding, and just an acknowledgement that our assessment funds are so competitive and needed across the country, just to kind of help spread out that resource to as many communities as possible.
Okay. I did have a comment going back to the removal program question. So there is a question to see if perhaps Ellen Fine, who's also joining us on the phone. Ellen, do you have any additional input on tribes applying for core program CAs to develop emergency response programs?
Yes, hi everybody. And actually the regulation that Christine has been referring to does allow specifically for states and tribes to work on procedures for emergency response actions using their core funds. So it's actually something that's expressly allowed.
Okay.
But obviously the reg does also reinforce too that there needs to be a balance, you know, in other needs that the tribe may have, and working with your regional point of contact, I think you can then best determine what kinds of what's the best mix of activities to be funded with this non-site specific funding.
All right, great. Thank you. Okay, I don't see any other questions electronically in the queue, so I think perhaps just in the interest of time, we might carry on. But remember, if you're in the audience, you can continue to send in your questions and comments electronically. So if you're in the middle of typing it, don't stop. You can submit it, and then we will pause again for questions. I believe we're going to now be joined by Tina Conley. Tina, are you on the phones?
Excuse me. I wasn't able to get the webinar up to submit a question. So I do have a question about this last section that we just covered relative
sure.
to the cooperative agreement. This is, of course, different than the 128 funding, correct? Correct?
Yes.
Okay. So does there have to be a proposed NPL site, or do you have to have a Superfund site within your tribal lands, or that could potentially affect your tribal lands to apply for that funding?
For all but the core program, it's site specific. So the core program is the one that is not.
Okay. So the core program, you can basically use that to do staff and capacity development for either emergency management or to participate should an event occur.
I believe so. Ellen, is that your reading as well? Because the core program is to develop and maintain your ability to participate.
Exactly, really, yeah, it really is sort of all of your other needs that are non-site specific, and you would work closely with your regional point of contact about what that scope would cover to make sure, because this is, you know, there has been a continuing focus within the National Superfund program to put these scarce dollars towards site specific work, but we do certainly allow for this non-site specific work. But again, you would have to work closely with your regional office on what your specific tribe's needs are that are non-site specific in nature to help you help support both your participation in, you know, emergency response activities as well as more traditional Superfund activities.
And how is there any confliction with entities that might be receiving the 128 funding for the voluntary response program?
So this is Ellen Fine from Superfund. I mean, I'd probably encourage Rachel to speak about more than 128A angle. One could see that there are some similarities in the non-site-specific components of core funding and the 128A funds. But the 128 funds certainly have different requirements, which Rachel alluded to, but I'd certainly look to Rachel to share more about those requirements.
Thank you.
Okay, just a quick reminder, we will be pausing at the end of today's session to do open Q&As by phone. So we will ask those of you who are in the Adobe environment, you can continue to submit your questions electronically. For those of you on the phones, we will invite you to come off of mute in just a few moments for an open phone Q&A period. So I think what we'll do is we'll go back to the presentation content. And again, I believe it's Tina Conley who will be joining us on the phone lines. Tina, are you with us?
I am. Thank you, Jean.
Thank you.
So I am going to talk through the technical assistance opportunities for your communities. Superfund has two main technical assistance programs for helping Superfund communities understand all the technical information related to a Superfund site. The two programs are the Technical Assistance Grant Program, what we refer to as TAG program, and the Technical Assistance Services for Communities Task Program. We often call these the support for communities technical information assistance. So this technical assistance related to a Superfund site is all about a community understanding what is happening in their Superfund site community. Technical assistance helps communities understand the science, the Superfund regulatory processes and regulations, technical documents that can be fairly long and very technical. And now there are also some differences between these programs. So Bob and I are going to walk you through the two programs, and then Bob will come back and summarize and kind of take you through a comparison of the two programs to help you better understand what they're all about. So I'll hand it over to Bob, a TAG coordinator in Region 1 and a national expert on technical assistance grants.
Perfect. This is Bob Sulak. So this slide basically goes over the technical assistance grant program that's administered here at the EPA. So TAGs are federal grants with an initial award of up to $50,000. The site for which the technical assistance is being provided must be on the national priorities list or proposed for the NPL with an action underway, and the group must be eligible in order for the award to effectively take place. Through a technical assistance grant, the grant recipient procures their own technical advisor, and the funds cover assistance for technical information that is site cleanup related only. So to counterpose this, I'm actually going to turn it back to Tina Connolly to now discuss the TASC program.
And Tina, you'll need to unmute your line if you're still with us on the phone.
Yes, I am. Sorry about that. So the TASC program provides information assistance through an EPA contract at no cost to communities. The support can go directly to communities or to EPA regions, and I'll talk a little bit more about those types of services. So through the contract, there are a host of skill sets available to meet the specific information needs for each project, and what we call a project, it comes up from a community need, whether it's a hydrogeologist to explain technical information directly to the community, or an individual with graphic design experience to develop an infographic for EPA's use in outreach documents and in all about helping the community better understand what is happening. The TASC program can provide a range of support services. So a large majority of the TASC support is focused on providing documents and information review and interpretation directly to communities. So we take these record of decisions, for example, that can be many hundreds of pages, and we will interpret those in plain English and translate them to the community so they are able to better understand, and then also they are able to directly participate in the decision-making process by enabling them to submit comments. So, for example, another example of technical assistance was provided to help a Region 8 community understand the soil excavation and evaporation pond construction work plan. That's even hard to say in its title. So this provided a technical advisor that went to the community and gave a presentation and a summary and a handout helping them understand this very technical document. Information materials can also be developed directly for communities, such as a layered map and an outreach package. In a Region 9 site, we helped them communicate site information and serve their community members' needs, and the community actually asked for this map, and this all came together in this outreach package to help them better understand what was happening in their Superfund community. There's also facilitation services that can be utilized as part of a TASC project to assist with discussions and just help focus the conversation on the technical information assistance and help community groups and community members understand what is happening at their Superfund site. So Bob, I'll hand it over to you to summarize and do this comparison of the facilities and then of course of the services, and then take questions.
Yep. So we have included this final slide as a reference for you to refer back to later. So I'm not going to go into this table into great detail, but this table illustrates the differences between these two funding mechanisms, the Technical Assistance Grant and the Technical Assistance Services for Communities Contract, basically upon fundamental lines. So most significantly, it counterposes these two different programs based on the breadth of the support activities that are provided, the differences in the eligibility requirements for the two different programs, the differences in advisor selection. So for TAGS, essentially the community would procure and hire their own technical advisor, and through TASC, the EPA would essentially work with the community to select the appropriate advisor, and finally the responsibilities of the community themselves in effectively managing these two different types of assistance. So with this, this actually concludes our presentation, and we would like to open it up for questions and answers.
All right. Thank you so much. So for those of you who are still in the Adobe Connect environment, I will again remind you that the Q&A window is open, so you can continue to send in questions or comments there. While we wait to see if any other electronic questions come in, I'd like to turn to those of you who are participating only on the phone lines. I know there are a few who are calling in just on the phone. If you are on the phones and you have a question for any of our presenters, you can unmute your phone line by pressing #6. So again, it's the number sign and 6 on the phone to unmute. If you're on the phone lines, feel free to unmute by pressing #6 and share your question with our speakers. All right, I'm not hearing anybody come off of mute on the phones. I am seeing some comments coming in to the Q&A window, just thanking our presenters for covering their materials, so we do note that. If you have no additional questions for the presenters, you can also enter that into the Q&A window just to confirm that they've addressed all of your questions and concerns for the session. So feel free to send in a message and say you don't have any questions. And otherwise, I see a couple that are starting to come in online, so we'll turn to those, and then I'll turn back to the phone lines here in just a moment to see if anyone has a question. So bear with me. We'll come back to the phone callers here in a moment. This next question asks, if the 3-year performance period for assessment grants, can it be shortened as needed for hugely contaminated sites? And I'm not sure if they meant hugely or if it's a typo. They gave an example and said it's easier to spend money faster when there is a lot to assess. And so again, I think this question is for Rachel. So Rachel, if you're on the phones, if you could help answer that one. Again, they wanted to know, can the 3-year performance period for an assessment grant be shortened as needed for hugely contaminated sites? Example, it's easier to spend money faster when there is lots to assess.
Yes. So for our competitive grants, anyone who's selected for funding, it's the full grant amount when the grant is awarded. So they are not incrementally awarded. So each entity would get $300,000 for a community-wide assessment grant, or up to $500,000 for a cleanup grant, and then up to $800,000 for a multi-purpose grant. And then if a project period lasts less than the 3 years, that's totally fine and acceptable.
Okay. All right. We did have another question. If someone could talk about tribal liability, which is a large concern for tribes and tribal businesses.
So this is Rachel. It's in the Brown Hills context. So under CERCLA, tribes are not defined as a person who is part of the CERCLA liability scheme of joint and several liability. So if you have like contamination that falls under the definition of hazardous substance, pollutant, or contaminant, a tribe doesn't have to demonstrate liability the way other eligible entities do. The one issue is petroleum. So petroleum is also excluded from the definition of like contaminants that are addressed under CERCLA, and that's covered under another statute, under our RCRA statute. And so petroleum brownfields has a separate eligibility determination that talks about viable and liable, and this is like a really important thing to kind of ask like an EPA regional project officer, just to talk about your specifics, because tribes will have to demonstrate that they meet those eligibility determinations because petroleum isn't addressed under CERCLA. And I don't know if Christine or Amanda want to talk about Superfund at all.
Christine, if you're
there,
you
want to
unmute? Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. No, I don't think that there's any difference in the definitions for the different parts. So I think Rachel covered it. Thank you, Rachel.
All right. Again, we'll turn back to the telephone lines to see if there are any questions by phone. Remember, you can unmute by pressing #6.
Hi, Jean.
Yes.
This is Mary Gooley, Region 10 in Alaska, and I wasn't able to join at the very beginning. Just wanted to check in. I saw that this is being recorded, so if people weren't able to join today, that they can go back to the same CLUIN page and look at a recording. Would that be great information for me to share with our tribes in Region 10?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and actually we'll cover those reminders at the very end, but indeed you are correct. The webinar was recorded. The link to the recording will automatically get emailed to everyone who attended today as soon as it's available. Usually takes us about a week to put the recording up, but as soon as you get the email, you are absolutely welcome to forward it on to colleagues who would value from playing it back on demand. The presentation slides and a variety of resources that were highlighted are already posted right now, so those can actually be linked and shared with partners right now. You don't even have to wait for that part. Right,
okay,
thanks for the question.
I see that in the Q&A. Yep.
Okay. Again, if anybody else on the phone lines has a question or comment, it is #6. You can feel free to unmute and ask your question. Okay. I don't hear anybody else on the phones, and I don't see any other questions coming into the queue, just a few messages of people saying thank you and then noting that they had no additional questions. So I will just double check to see if Amanda Van Epps has any final statements she wanted to share before I walk us through some closeout procedures for today's event.
No, just thank you again, everyone, for joining, and I would say, too, that when the final presentation is posted, we will be sure to share it in the Olam weekly tribal roundup that gets distributed to our regional partners and then from them to the tribes in their region as well, so people can look for a link to that recording there in a few weeks.
Okay. With that, let me walk through just a few quick closing reminders before we formally end today's live broadcast. First, I wanted to echo Amanda's thanks to all of you who chimed in for today's live broadcast. We did have nearly 80 individuals who joined us for today's live broadcast. We appreciate everyone being flexible and working with us as we are working through some challenging times. We do appreciate everybody connecting for today's live broadcast. I also wanted to thank our presenters who joined us to share their expertise. I will encourage those of you who are on today's session, if you're interested in learning about more webinars like this in the arena of cleaning up hazardous waste sites, I encourage you to visit us at CLUIN.org or to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, where we highlight webinars like today's session each month. We do have copies of the presentation material, and then as noted, a number of websites that were discussed already posted on the seminar links or resources page. So the same page that you used to register, the same page that you would have been directed to check in for the live event, there are tabs on that page which have information about the session description, our presenters, their contact information, their slides, related links. I encourage you to visit those pages. They'll be active from today forward, so you can certainly point people to them to access these resources. And I'll ask you to fill out a brief feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. Many times I get asked for participation certificates, and we can offer those to those who submit feedback. So if you follow the link to the seminar feedback form, again, it's one of the tabs on that homepage, and I also have it available in the Q&A window and the related pods window in the webinar. Once you visit that page and complete the online feedback form, please be sure to fill in your email address correctly and completely, and then check the box at the very bottom of the form to certify you were here for the whole session. As soon as you submit feedback, you'll then have access to a participation certificate that you can either print out or save for your own records. If you happen to join together in a group, which is probably unlikely given the current circumstances, but if you did have a few others with you, each person can actually fill out that feedback form on their own, even if they didn't register individually. So I'd ask that you be sure to share the URL to the feedback form with others who may have joined with you under your connection so they can share their own thoughts and get their own certificate. And then as noted, today's session was recorded, and you'll automatically get an email as soon as that archive is available. And at that point, you'll be able to forward it on to others who will find it useful. So with that, I'll go ahead and thank everyone who joined us, sharing their comments and questions, as well as our presenters for sharing their expertise. We will go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast.